This episode comes with a content warning. We talk about self-harm and suicide, as well as the trauma brought on by religious indoctrination. If you're in need of resources or support, please go to suicidepreventionlifeline.org or call Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. The Lifeline provides free and confidential support for anyone in distress and prevention and crisis resources for you or your loved ones 24/7. If you live outside the U.S., look for the local resources in your community. Christine Hall is an artist and a poet, and everything she says has a beauty and elegance to it. If you've lived in Nashville a long time and need a pep talk about why you should stay in this new version, this It City version, she's the person to talk to. Seeing it through her eyes will make you fall in love with this place all over again. Christine lived in upstate New York before her parents uprooted the family and took her to Nashville when she was just 14. Fast forward a few decades, and she's thriving as a woman, a visionary artist, and a mother, and she works really hard to build and support community in unlikely places. But the roads she traveled to get to the place where she feels at home in Nashville and the Nashville arts community were sometimes rough. Christine's words are beautiful and elegant, even the ones she carefully chooses to tell the difficult stories about her painful past, some of which happened during the time she was a regular at Lucy's. How would you describe what you do?
I'm an experimental artist. I dabble in every medium that I can get my hands on. I like to run the circuit and mix and match, and I like multimedia. So I write poetry, I write prose. I'm working on a novel memoir right now. I make experimental poem videos. I love to curate shows for other artists and to collaborate. Yeah, I will bring in collage work, or I will paint sometimes. My favorite is making trash sculptures. I've been doing that for some decades now. Who really enjoys helping other artists along because of community. I was raised in a messed up community, specifically a cult, and my family was a bit of a mess too.
Where was that? Where were you
that
raised?
That was upstate New York. Not that different from the more rural areas of Tennessee, but...
How did you get to Nashville? What year was that?
That was 1994. It was right after my freshman year, and I... Oh, goodness. We had a sweet little punk boyfriend. Finally, just a glimmer of a bright spot in upstate New York. And then my parents uprooted us and took us here. And we stopped in this little country store. It was our first stop inside Tennessee. And there was like, you know, rocking chair, front porch. Somebody was actually whittling wood. I have a poem about this. We went inside and there was like rebel flags. And a man with a very long beard came up to me and said something I couldn't understand. And it was quite cliche and terrifying for me. Culture shock.
Right. I mean, that's a very tender age, right, to experience that big of a change.
Yeah. And then in a way, it just registers as this is how it goes. Like, oh, what's drama? What's drama? It's all drama. It's all change. Everything's in upheaval all the time. The way that my life won't, even if somebody said something slightly nasty to me, I mean, I internalize that so much and would just carry it with me. And it's so, okay, moving across the country, that's a big deal. It is... Yeah, it's a big change. On the other hand, it's like, oh, I could naively convince myself, oh, this is a fresh start. I can reinvent myself. So I don't know. I dyed my hair. I shaved my hair. I started hanging out with new people who made me feel less alone. So that was one of the cool things. Even though Nashville was real sleepy then, I could smell it coming awake. And there, because of the affordability, there was a great underground art scene. And that's always very exciting to stay up all night dreaming up ideas and taking photos and writing stories and then going on road trips and then bringing back, your talismans and putting them together. And it's, yeah, no, it gave me access to much more than I think I would have had in upstate New York, just because it was a town coming awake. And now here it's, ooh.
Did your parents move to Nashville to escape the cult?
They escaped an aspect of the cult. My dad, who was disabled, got a settlement for a botched back operation, and they used it to take the whole family to Nashville when I was 14. They had always wanted to make it in the music business. I spent my earliest years in like the LA area with them performing.
The cult thing is fascinating, though. And if you're not comfortable talking
about
it.
Okay. I mean, or I rather relish on discomfort and working through it.
Right. So I'm sure that fuels your art and your work a lot. But what were the tenets of the cult? Like, what made it a cult?
I mean, there's so much religious trauma. I connect with a lot of people through this, and I'm grateful for that because we certainly need that, because it can... I mean, specifically, Jehovah's Witnesses teach that you are not of the world, that you're separate, and specifically call people who aren't Jehovah's Witnesses worldly. So no holidays, no worldly friends, anyone who I wanted to be friends with, if they weren't already a Jehovah's Witness, we had to study the Bible. Bible study was... And so actually, one of my earliest friends who... I met in school, and her mother was studying the Bible, and then I was studying the Bible with her, which is how we were allowed to hang out. She started questioning some of the things, which had never set right with me either. It didn't quite jive. And she brought up some feminist ideas, and, well, why aren't women leaders? And, you know, this doesn't match with that. And that was cool. Yeah, that gave me some freedom to really openly question and have someone to talk with, so...
You said you dabble in all sorts of different art, but did it start with writing, or did it start with poetry?
It did start with poetry, for sure. Whether that was, you know, nursery rhymes or the songs that we made up around the house. I feel the poem in the moment, and that is the art of it to me. And I understand the distinctions between this is a poem, and this is a song, and this is a painting. I feel the poetry in every moment. There's a golden moment. It depends on the perspective, right? Where whatever your mind frame is, whatever angle you're hitting it from, there's a poem in every moment. Every moment is a work of art. It's just like, how do we want to express this? You know, how do we best want to synthesize this particular experience? My entire family is artists. It just was.
Do you remember the first thing you wrote?
That had to be a little song that I wrote on the way home from the bus stop in first grade. Yeah.
Can you sing it for us?
Oh, goodness. Oh, how cute and sweet. Oh, gosh. You'll see what a sad, romantic little girl. Oh. Okay. I am a punk. Let's emphasize that. This is better screamed.
Hey, however way you
want
to do it.
Yeah, we'll just be a child. Here we go. Oh, so long ago, I dreamt of happiness. Oh, it came like the sun, and it went like the rain. How I wish I could see happiness again. Once upon a time, I was with you, my love, but now you are gone, and I dedicate this song to all who have loved but lost. You said it was true, you'd be back to renew the love that we had when we first made our vows. Now that I miss you and I want you back, you're gone from my sight and my whole world is black.
Wow.
I was a dark and heavy little girl, and it didn't go away. I will not sing the second verse, but I will say in my 20s, I wrote a second verse to try and make a happy ending.
A romantic, always a romantic.
I mean, I got really mad at myself because I felt like I spent too much of my life pursuing the romance. That was another aspect of the cult. And also the culture, you know, a lot of this idea fed to a little girl of growing up and finding the man and being a wife and mother. I very much bought into that. And I don't know how much of it is my natural inclination and how much of it was expectation. But I know that none of my romantic relationships held up to expectation. And I felt, you know, like I had a scholarship to college, and I won't pretend like I would have done well with that had I taken it. I probably would have slept through class and crammed. I might have gotten a degree out of it and might have had an easier time. I don't know. But what I did was immediately upon graduating high school a year early was leave for San Francisco to go be with the girl who I loved, who said I would have a place when I graduated. I ended up on the street there because of complications. And then, yeah, traveled around a bit. Definitely romance has altered the course of my life many, many times, and I have made some abrupt and unwise decisions. You know, the follow your heart thing. I've had some brilliant experiences I wouldn't have otherwise. Yeah. And I can write about it. I can make art about it.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
I wonder, too, how much of that was me trying to collect a story. I knew I wanted an interesting story. I heard on a show recently, I think it was Sex Education. Yeah, there's a poet teen character who said something I used to say when I was a teen. He was like, boring people get bored. I'm like, yeah, I just wanted an interesting story. Yeah. I was interested in what would happen tomorrow. I put myself in very dangerous situations, wondering what would happen, testing humanity, like living my life as an experiment. Because basically I knew that most of what I was fed was not true, was not proving out. And I figured I'd start from scratch, which maybe I didn't have to do that, but I wanted to generate my own sort of worldview.
Yeah, sure.
And pull on as many as I could to do that.
Yeah. So how did you discover Lucy? So you move here when you're 14. Mm-hmm. And then how did Lucy's even come on your radar?
Oh, some cool people found me. I had older friends.
But where did you find them?
Yeah. Okay. So that's the funny thing is we were the renegades of the Jehovah's Witness congregation. A girl came up to me after the first meeting I went to, and she introduced herself to me, and that was, talk about awakening. I was like, hey, here, I recognize you. You are a human I can relate to. And there was that recognition between us, like, okay. And so she was very well-versed in music, and there were quite a few people who she already had in her friend group. I was the younger kind of outsider one, but I really loved being with them and learning and soaking it all up. I remember, like, we were riding around town and they were singing the Pixies' Hey, and I was like, that was a revelation to me. I was like, And taking that biblical imagery and turning it on its head like that, I was like, yes, this is what I need. Scoop that out and make a scramble. It pleased me so deeply. And then, yes, that Lucy's was all age. Here was a place we could go. I mean, yeah, we hung out at Cafe Elliston and Perkins, and, you know, there were a few coffee houses that opened and closed during those times that stayed up all night. But we had Lucy's, and I remember those calendars, and we would all get decked out and go out, and yeah, I would usually stick to the wall. But sometimes I jumped in the pit, and I say this with glee. I don't know if you can hear that. I can't.
Just
I have
heard
a
it.
Click in my jaw to this day from that mosh pit.
What?
Somebody coming through, just fist forward, just full connect, a flu. Powerful. But
what?
No, that's my little souvenir. I cherish it.
What kept you coming back? Was it the music? Was it the community?
There was being allowed. There wasn't anywhere where I felt like I was allowed to be me, you know? I could stick against the walls. I was fine. I could jump in the mosh pit. Whether or not I could hold my own, like, nobody else was going to tell me not to, you know? I could just be. And the music was exciting. There was new things happening. I remember seeing you and being like, it became a beacon for me because I was like, I love people who do things. You're doing things. You're giving people a place to express and to exist, right? The all ages aspect of it was so important for me because it wasn't like I wasn't borrowing IDs to get in other places, but I wasn't allowed. So just to be allowed was so precious, so meaningful, so important. Thank you, Mary. Well,
thank you. While you were coming there, Were you making art at the time?
Well, I was doing the trash sculptures definitely all the time because it was like my little way of rearranging the world and leaving my mark. So like, I don't know, if I found a toy rat, you know, I'd perch it up on a pole and then wrap a twist tie around and dangle, you know, some kind of strange mobile there on the spot. That kind of thing. That was how I was expressing myself. I was doing artistic modeling at the time. I had friends, you know, that I would act as a photographer's assistant and then sometimes model. We would have, you know, all night philosophizing sessions and then like, okay, now we're going to make some really cool pictures that would result in things like my hair on fire. You know, I loved being a part of it, part of the creation. So yes, I've always enjoyed feeding other people's creations while I'm making my own as well.
I mean, you said it so eloquently. There was a lot of room. People gave each other room there.
Yeah.
We only had a couple of hard and fast rules.
Oh, the best rules in the world! I remember your creed. Yes, that was perfection. No homophobia, no racism.
No sexism allowed. No shit. None of that shit tolerated.
Yay!
And then also the no drinking and no smoking thing. Mm-hmm. And that was a really hard and fast rule too, which is an interesting concept really to think. If you think about it now, there had to be those rules in order to create that space that made you feel so comfortable.
Right. And so that's interesting, the push and pull of that. Certain restrictions allow you to be more free within them or open up a new dimension of creativity. But like, it's a sanctioned space. It's sacred space. And so there needs to be some sort of rules of engagement for something like that. Basic human respect. Basic decency. Otherwise, we can't coexist, you know?
What did you love most about Lucy's? Did you have a favorite band or record or zine?
I got a few things. All right. Well, my favorite zine is actually the girl who found me at the Jehovah's Witness congregation and started taking me to all these cool places, including Lucy's. She was making a zine and I was helping her. And that was when I really started conceptualizing of turning the things in my journal into poems that could live outside of the journal too. Started performing my first with parties she did. That was Scattered. And it was specifically Jehovah's Witnesses scattered across the earth and coming together with this little, our unique experience, little pamphlet. Okay, so that was zine. That was parallel, but not within. Now within Lucy's, all right, so first of all, I'm going to talk about Mother Hubbard, which I was so excited. I remember they covered Blue Moon and just screamed the whole thing. It was so cool. I loved it. And I had that audio cassette for so long. I hung on to it. And I always drive an old car, and my car had an audio cassette player, so it was in my car. And I ran into the singer at Cafe Coco, and he didn't have a copy anymore, so I gave it to him, or else I would have brought it here to show you. I remember shows like Brazen Youth and Teen Idols and Fun Girls from Mount Pilot. I have a little story about the singer from Brazen Youth. One day, and yeah, like you said, no drinking, no smoking, but certainly, as you know, we were, many of us, pouring our troubles out like that anyway. And after a particularly rough night and a morning, I had climbed up on top of, I think that was the World's End next to. And I was just sitting up there, and I was wondering what would happen. I'm going to talk about some nasty stuff here. If you've got sensitivities about, self-harm. That was something I engaged in a lot of at the time. So I was wondering what would happen if I just took a straight dive into the concrete, like if that would be enough. And Charles Walker came by, lead singer of Brazen Youth, and like called up to me, called me down, and said, come on, let's go. And we'd never hung out before, but he rescued me for real that day. I have thanked him since, you know, that was real though. That happened. Like, yeah, I spent the day with him and he was sweet to me. I wrote a poem about it. that was beautiful human connection, moment of tenderness, super kind punk, right?
Yeah.
We know that we're putting on these spikes to protect our tender hearts. We know this.
Did you, when he rescued you like that, it was just, that's beautiful. Mm. Did you, when you spent the day together, did you talk about what made you think about doing it? Mm. Did you go that deep?
That's one of those where I remember how he made me feel, not what he said. Just made me feel human.
Yeah.
See.
Did the self-harm continue for you after that? And when did it stop?
Yeah. It stopped when I promised my friend I would stop. I was wearing myself into my body. I was choosing an outlet for the pain that I could control. Really liked the idea of scarification and bemoaned our society's lack of rites of passage. So it was just, again, something I could control. I was too young to get tattoos. Couldn't really do that myself. I mean, I did manage to eke in for a tattoo somewhere sometime, but mostly I gave them to myself without color. And there was a real bad one right before I graduated. And I remember the teacher looked at me when she saw it one day, and she just said, "Terrible wound." And she was so serious. And that connected with me. There was, like, not really, nobody else had ever really reacted with concern or just, like, appalled or judgmental, you know?
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. Even, like, just that thing of, like, saying somebody's just doing it for attention. Attention is a human need.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or, I mean, like, somebody's just trying to make their outsides match their insides. I am wounded.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
There's all sorts of ways to be honest, really. So, yeah, a friend asked me not to do it again. So I made one mark to remember by. Mm. This pain was real. I will never question the reality of someone else who says they are experiencing this pain, who shows they are experiencing this pain. But I understand I can't live in this current incarnation, so I have to move past it.
People have been bringing mementos from their days at Lucy's to these recording sessions. Christine brought with her a spiral-bound yellow notebook with Sweet Dreams and Lullabies handwritten on the cover. Most of the entries were from 1996, the year she graduated high school, and she said they were all about the people she had met at Lucy's. She read one from Wednesday, March 27th, 1996.
My mother hates my guts, and I don't like her much either, but what am I to do? I am forsaken, and my tears are salty. I have nothing? No one? Nowhere? I want to go walking, but I don't have any shoes. Take my advice, leave them behind. Yeah, well, I guess the blue meanies are my god. Have to have some god. I waxed my legs and Paul Jensen bit my stomach. Me and April and Paul and Steve spent the night here Saturday. Split 5/5 of Mad Dog, which everybody's friend Keith from Teen Idols bought us. We watched Sid and Nancy and drank. April and I kissed. Paul passed out. Steve puked all over the living room, dreadful bright red purple. April and me threw up in the bathrooms. Abby and David awake. We screamed at the top of our lungs, crying for Tila and Craig. Decided to take a bath. Woke up naked in a pool of water. And that's what I looked like.
Let me see. Oh, you shaved your head.
It was my junior pick, which became my senior pick because I did both those years together, thankfully. I wouldn't have made it another year.
Has your relationship with your mom gotten better?
Well, my mom's always nurtured creativity. That thing I'm talking about, nurturing life, nurturing creativity. I was in a death stance. That's the real deal. Like, a few pages later, I'm talking about how she's dumping out my 3 bottles of cough syrup and calling me a drug addict. Like, oh my goodness. How terrifying for a mom, you know?
Sure.
Well, I mean, we try to do one turn better every generation, but, like, yeah, I know how she was raised, and then I know that she joined the cult to find community for herself, and also because she couldn't really trust the decisions she was making because, you know, some of them were messed up. I experienced that in my 20s. Oh, crap. I thought I did have it figured out. I've ruined everything. Yeah. So, I mean, no, my mom always nurtured creativity. And I think she saw me being destructive. And, you know, that caused a great amount of clash. But also, you know, there was a messy time in life. She was going through a divorce with my dad, who was a crack addict. Mm. Yeah, it was a mess. It was a terrible, terrible mess. And she's trying to parent 4 children. And I'm like, at least I convinced her to leave the Jehovah's Witnesses. I do feel like things got better after that. I asked her if the rules were making her happy. Talk about rules and boundaries. They had an excess, yeah. Mm. And just asked her. Yeah.
You asked her and she said, mm. No.
Yeah. And she was gone. That was it.
Yeah. And then you graduated. Mm. And you were in love.
I was, yeah. I was in love with a couple people. But specifically, one of them went to jail and the other one went to San Francisco. So I went to San Francisco. Yeah. That graduation night, that was a big three-way split. There were three invitations. I could go in three different places, three different directions. San Francisco definitely had the strongest beacon. I'd visited once right after she moved there. And I mean, went to a Lush record release party for AD, like, woo, you know, magical, wonderful, drank champagne on the stoop. And yeah, you know, it was a city that, yeah, it kicked my ass. It overwhelmed me with all the tantalizing options.
And you got there and was just not what you expected? Was the relationship not?
It was so fraught with difficulty. She was a little older and I was a little younger. I was trying to get emancipated. But I mean, it wasn't exactly an appropriate relationship. We were both so wounded and damaged, though, and, you know, traumatized in tandem. It was a bonding experience, and we were genuinely in love. It's tough, but it just, you know, it wasn't feasible, and I couldn't live with her. It couldn't be a real thing, you know, and whatever had happened when we were drunk, well, we were both very drunk, you know. It's,
yeah,
young people acting out their trauma.
It's not a new story.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So, I mean, I couldn't live with her. Her roommates were especially not down with that. So, yeah, I was on the street for a while. And
what was it that made you, that must have been a horrible experience.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I remember Mama Cat. There was a street woman who helped take care of us, street rats. It was very sweet, Mama Cat.
So you had a community even on the street?
A little bit, yeah, but still, I was on the fringes, wherever I was. I'm the fringe of the fringes. Like, I just had to put myself there. I didn't want to be kicked out of anywhere. I hated that feeling so much. I liked thumbing my nose at people, but I didn't really like getting in trouble for it because I cry so easily. I was like, you know, I don't know. One of my proudest moments, though, I was on my period, and I was a writer, and I went into the Safeway, and I got myself a little pad of paper and a pen, and then shoved a bunch of tampons out of the box into my pocket, and I got caught on the way out, and the poor security guard misspoke and asked me to open my shirt. So I very loudly said, "You want me to lift up my shirt?" And he was just like, and pointed at the tampons that were really spilling out of my pocket. And he was like, "What's those?" I'm like, "I am on my period. What?" And he was like, "Just go." That was maybe one of the more outrageously outspoken things. It's part of why it's so important for me to put it in poems, because I'm afflicted by the spirit of the staircase logic. I always think afterwards, oh, I could have said that, you know, and then, so just put it in a poem, and then you can say it with confidence on stage, and you're not actually even hurting anyone's feelings because it's nothing personal.
Mm. What was the hardest part about living on the streets?
Mm. Not having anywhere to put your stuff. I mean, you just like, yeah, I was limited to the backpack. I had to let go of my 20 old Doc Martens. It was really hard.
But where? I mean, not sleep and not food?
I mean, I was young enough that I didn't really care about sleep, and food wasn't that hard. I was so hungry for so long. I mean, we were food insecure when I was younger. I remember being hungry all the time. I remember in high school, I never had like money for the lunch or anything, like maybe a thing of French fries, and I would use as much ketchup and mustard, like that equal amounts to, yeah. So the food, no, not so much. I found it pretty easy to get a job. So I would just eat at the coffee house where I worked. I took showers for a little while in my friend's art studio with a little basin, or more frequently there was a gas station. I think it was a Chevron, and I would get like one of their big soft drink cups and go in the bathroom that had a drain in the floor and shower there. Or there was one place, a spa, that was so nice. They would let you for $6 have half an hour in their little spa bathtub. That was very sweet.
Was it hard to not have a place to put your stuff because these are things that were meaningful to you?
Right. Mementos are really important to me.
Right, yeah. Right.
Yeah, it was tough because, yeah, pare down like that. Mm-hmm. I love to express myself through material things, having a space that's my own and being able to make in that space, just not having access. And like, I have a drink I carry with me. If you don't have somewhere to set it down, it's like you just always have a weight on you, you know?
Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to come back to Nashville after that? That was a 2-year period?
Yeah, I didn't really decide to come back to Nashville. I got in some trouble with cocaine. I noticed that I was doing everything between lines. I was friends with a dealer. I started riding the line of trading things for drugs, which I was conscious was an interesting thing to do, but it was starting to really burn me. I had people like come to my apartment at the rooming house, and that started to get scary. I was kidnapped once. I don't really remember how that ended. I remember being in the back of a van, but I left town in quite a hurry. I had like $400 saved up, and I mostly to get away from the cocaine, mostly because I just felt it closing in on me. I was in trouble. I knew I was. And so I had some friends who were leaving town, so I hitched a ride with them. And we went up to Vancouver, and then we traveled around for a while. We went down to Florida, and then we landed back in Nashville. And I tried to stay with my mom for a little bit, but it's not a peaceful reintegration. So went to stay with a friend. And then the other person I was in love with, who was in jail before, got out of jail. So we moved to Savannah together. I read Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil on the way there, and it felt like I was stepping into the book when we arrived. It's an amazing place.
So you're back in Nashville, and then a short trip to Savannah, but you've been here ever since.
Yeah. I did still travel a while for work, but I set down roots here pretty quick. Made a good circle of friends, and ended up a very close friend who had rescued me briefly in San Francisco, right before I ended up getting my apartment in the rooming house, passed away from cancer, left me $20,000. I bought a house here in Nashville. So that was huge to me because I was raised in a trailer and, you know, I just never really felt settled anywhere. And so, yeah, I wanted to be a mom. I wanted a home. And so, yeah, we moved right into that phase of life.
Wow, you were young.
Yeah, I felt like I had lived so long already and partied so hard. I was tired of that. That was enough.
Where do you think the desire to be a mom came from? Because not everybody has that. And not everybody has it that young.
Well, I remember when my youngest brother was born, I think I was 11, and that I wanted him to be my baby. I wanted to take care of him. Part of it was a natural nurturing. I was definitely always babysitting and enjoyed that. But also, I think I wanted to make my own family, partly because like I wanted to do it better, and partly just because I needed community, you know, and the friends are great, but I just really wanted something that was mine, my own space, and these are my people, this is, you know, yeah.
What does your community look like now?
Well, now, wow, we're all over the world now, because through the pandemic, the open mic that I hosted went online. And yeah, we started welcoming people from Australia and Pakistan.
Talk a little bit about the open mic that you host, right? Yeah. So how did you get to host that? How did that become a community of people?
Mm-hmm. I'll go roundabout here, because I think ever since what I saw you doing with Lucy's and what I saw my friend doing with the zine and people who do things, right? I wanted to do things. I tried to open a community art center in Germantown in 2005, like a really cool fundraiser with the Swindlers at Belcourt, and it was wonderful. So it was just this Victorian mansion, and we were in the bottom floor making art and having shows, and that was grand. We couldn't get it to pass codes, and it ended up closing. Okay, so I had always wanted to do something with community, right? And always something with the arts, and have a community of people creating in proximity, collaborating, but also learning from each other, you know, that like exponential sort of thing that happens. And I didn't know. I was spinning rudderless, and I had always written poetry, and my mom would every once in a while tell me about open mics. I performed a few times, but then she was just like, well, just choose something and stick to it for a year. And she dropped some info about an open mic at Cafe Coco called Night of Free Speech. And I went, and I loved it. Oh my goodness, I loved it. I loved performing. I loved like deadlocking someone's eyes and like saying these
just abysmal, just atrocious, outlandish things. Whoa, it was so exciting to me, and like to feel that emotional connection, like ha ha ha, ha. You know? Okay, so that was great. And then I started going to more open mics, and one of them was Poetry in the Brew, which started in 2011, and by then it was 2013, and I became a regular. And then 1 month, it didn't happen. There was no Poetry in the Brew. The guest host that they'd chosen was accused of sexual harassment, and this was before Me Too, and There were some disagreements between the three organizers about how to handle it. They each talked to me about this, and they ended up just canceling the night, whereas I was like, this is a really important thing for people. Like, I would just say, well, you know, while this is going on, this guest host won't be going up. We're not going to center someone when there's this question.
Yeah.
Right. The three organizers came to me independently, each of them, because they were having conversations about what was going on. I was friends with each of them, and each of them like mentioned that they'd kind of over the last 3 years, like they had enough and they were ready to move on. Would I be interested, you know, in organizing? And at the time we had guest hosts. So I was like, oh, okay, sure. Right. So one of the original organizers stayed on as an advisor, and I brought the sound system every month, set it up. And, you know, booked features and guest hosts, and the show kept running. It was really cool. And then, like, after a while, I think I'd like to try hosting. I've been a guest host a few times. This is the fun part. So if I'm going to do all the work of organizing, I'm going to let myself host, and we'll just keep booking features. So every once in a while, we still have a guest host. But I really like to host because I was raised at open mics, and then I'd gone to so many open mics, and part of when I'm in a space, like, I like to feel like I belong there. And part of what helps me do that is if I have a job to do, I feel purpose. I don't necessarily like to just spectate or occupy space, though the presence is important. Mm-hmm. If it's a continual reoccurring thing, I like to pick up a job to go along with it. I'm kind of fidgety that way. Yeah, I started doing that. And Nashville was really waking up during those years, getting bigger and bigger, and the attendance was growing and growing. We had to change the format a few times. The thing about Poetry in the Brew is it's always had its own momentum. It's an event where you get many different kinds of voices with many different experiences and backgrounds coming together in one space to share their art, to share what they know, and to receive, right? The listening is beautiful. The sharing is beautiful. It's different every time, but it's got a singular vibe. People who come through recognize, like, ah, this is Poetry Church. We had a filmmaker from Brazil who was making a documentary on micropolitics and poetry and the punk scene and came through and in an interview. That was right before pandemic, so the film didn't actually get finished and released. But we had, you know, the word had gotten out in Nashville, there is an open mic. Which is cool because when the original organizers created Poetry in the Brew, there wasn't a regular poetry open mic at that time. It was filling a void. There was kind of a space between the 90s heyday, and then when we were in the early aughts, there was a little bit of a dearth right before we exploded. So they filled that space, and the way that it's grown with the community and the community's grown with it, it's cool. There's a reciprocity there. It's a driving force.
Do you see a connection between punk and poetry?
100%. The punk poet is like, that's an archetype. It's a thing. Yeah, I mean, that's what I saw. I like that kind of poetry, the pastoral stuff. I'm just like, not super interesting to me. That's cool. I like peace. I love nature. I garden. I love to go to the wilderness. I don't need to write about it so much. That's not what I need an outlet for. I want to like be there for that. And then the stuff that gets me ootsy and icky, I got to get that out. I got to make something with that. Otherwise, it destroys me. And this is what I know. So I know a lot of people know this too and need a space for it. So I love to carry that torch. I love to pass it along. I love to see everyone's glowing lights coming together and then spreading out into the world.
I think it's powerful, real stuff to have a place where you're allowed to be. You're allowed to say what you got to say, so long as you respect everybody else, right?
Yeah.
And make the space for everybody else to have their turn, right? So we're all welcome and safe there. Or, I mean, like, you know, we can say dangerous stuff too, but we are demonstrably safe in one another's presence. It's super important to protect that, to have those boundaries.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting what's happening now in Tennessee and Nashville. We're in the midst of a real live book banning movement. There is a fear of words. Why do you think people are so afraid of words and ideas? And also, why do you stay here?
Huge, right? Huge. Okay, I have an allegiance to Nashville. I feel the magnetism of it. It has a creative spirit that's very powerful. It's been the center of many movements, civil rights movements, very important. We have people here still who participated in the lunch counter sit-ins, who were instrumental in these, in securing rights. And yeah, they're not all secured, nor are they all realized, the ones we thought were secured. Culture and counterculture swap places. There's, you know, the push and pull of that. But first, I wanted to acknowledge what you're saying about, oh, we thought we were going to be farther than this by now. We thought we'd won some battles that apparently we're fighting again. That's exhausting. It's painful. As much as I believe in going where the need is great, I also believe in letting yourself rest, you know, and regenerate. You have to choose a work that is sustainable for you if you want to be able to see it through to any kind of goal, or just if you want to be able to inhabit that work genuinely, right? And have any sort of meaning that you can derive from that other than just feeling like you're pouring into a hole and making no difference whatsoever. So, yeah, I mean, I took a little hiatus from the online Poetry in the Brew that we hosted, you know, over 70 shows in the first part of the pandemic, but back in December, I had to go on break from that. Mm. It's a lot of feelings to process, too, when you're really present with what's happening, with what people are saying about their experience, what they're communicating through their art. That's a lot of information.
Oh.
And it's overload, right? And we look around our
city. The pain mm-hmm. that comes through that, yeah.
Yeah. It's real. Every single experience, it's real. And if you actually allow yourself to be with it, oh, it'll blow you away every time. Mm-hmm. And yeah, what's happened in our city, this loss of any sort of feeling of connection to what's happening out there. I mean, they're completely out of touch with the residents and they're serving tourists. And then here we are in a pandemic. And so the tourists die down and it becomes starkly clear how little the city was built for the people who live here. And it could have been conscientiously developed, you know? We could have had a plan that served mm-hmm. things efficiently. We could be addressing the problems. We know this. It's frustrating. It's infuriating, really. You know, it is. And yeah, I could easily give up and give over to the doom. But yeah, then you see people coming together with the defiance and creating anyway. And the little pockets that are left, right? And yeah, maybe they spread further out. Maybe the slivers are smaller and smaller. But like, just like what you're talking about, setting those boundaries up for the safe space at Lucy's or at Poetry in the Brew, we have these places. And within those, we can create an infinity even when it's on the infinitesimal level. The availability of the nuance and the different shades that we can express, especially when pressed to this point, something opens up. Like, so many times I felt like I've painted myself into a corner, and it's like, yeah, there's always an escape route. We always can, but it doesn't necessarily have to be a permanent escape from the place. That might be the right thing. It might be, you know,
yeah.
There's needs everywhere. But we can also open up that trapdoor within ourselves, like where we've blocked ourselves, or focus on a new area, or look at it in a new angle, and always exposing myself to other artists creating helps to do that. I get out of my own shtick again, you know, and I'm like,
yeah, that's
oh,
key.
I'm re-energized. Like, oh, you're making something I never would have thought of. Your mind works in a way that mine has never even imagined a possibility. So cool. Thank you. Thank you. There's young people. I have children. I listen to the young people. And yeah, a lot of them are edging on doom too. And that sucks. That's,
yeah.
It's painful. I coming of age with this world. Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa. I just, for me, it's a knowing. I don't have another option. I have made a pledge to exist. I actually signed a pledge with my grandmother that I would not kill myself.
Mm.
I mean, in my family, that's been a huge issue with many, many people. However, I have made the pledge to be here. When I was younger, what kept me holding on is the interest of something might happen tomorrow. Even like with the dire circumstances of this world, with our city, like I look at the way that nature evolves answers to things, I believe. She can give us a surprise still. I still, like, I have to hang on. Like, if this was a movie and things have gone so much worse than you ever thought they were, and it looks like there's no way to save, but I'm still holding out that hope. Like, oh my gosh, wouldn't this be the perfect setup for something you never see coming? I have an allegiance. I have a commitment. It's something I feel in my heart. I've watched so much come alive in Nashville. I've got to hang on and see this through. It's not to say I won't travel. It's not to say I won't fall in love with another place. But this place has always felt like a creative magnet for me. And part of that is the rebellion of it, of doing it in the face of the country music industry.
Right.
Or in the face of, you know, whatever popular thing has taken root here in the pedal taverns, in the face of all of that.
Yeah.
I love the backlash to that. I think it is so exciting. And the rebellious movement always comes up with something surprising, right? You get forced into these corners and then you realize, oh, wow, so I wouldn't have been here otherwise and I'm finding freedoms here. Huh, go figure.
Yeah.
I mean, I would love for there to be freedoms everywhere, but we know there's boundaries everywhere. And then sometimes it's just the illusion of such and we can open up within that. I don't really have an answer for you on why I stay, other than, like, you just know sometimes. You just know things. I knew this city was going to wake up. I know it's my home. I know it's a center of a great movement. I've seen it with the civil rights movement. I've seen it continue through all these independent artists and all that they make and they exchange and they inspire with one another. People make real, meaningful connections through their creativity here. This town is a creative mecca, and I love even more what's happening on the underside, on the underbelly, you know, in the underground. That is where these new ideas come forth and, you know, gasp for air and sometimes see the light.
Yeah.
I believe in that, and I want to be present. I want to be part of it. I've hung on for this long. There's so little that I've seen through in my life. Like, I love Nashville. Mm. And I still have hope for it.
Thank you for listening. Again, if you're in need of resources or support, go to suicidepreventionlifeline.org or call Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. The Lifeline provides free and confidential support for people in distress and prevention and crisis resources for you and your loved ones. If you live outside the U.S., look for the local resources in your community. If you have stories, pictures, or music you'd like to share from your Lucy's Days, or questions or guest suggestions, send them along to @Lucy's Record Shop on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook, or email me directly at mary@lucysrecordshop.com. Many thanks to Michael Eads for his time and the use of his studio, and to Lamb Chop for the outro music. This show is brought to you by Give 40 the Finger Productions and We Own This Town, a podcast network of original entertainment and documentary content. You can find more info at their official site at weownthistown.net or follow @WeOwnThisTown on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Thanks again for listening.